Today we are moving to the book of Exodus, and really this is a continuation of what we did in Genesis. In the first two chapters, what we find is a crushing bondage, not just not just inconvenience, but crushing bondage as we come to this. In chapter 1, we see Jacob's family, who we saw leave Egypt in the book of Genesis. They're being blessed while they're in bondage. And you wouldn't think that'd be possible. That's what happens. That's what chapter 1 describes. And chapter 2 describes a new figure on the scene. This is going to become a very familiar figure to us. You know who this is. And Moses arrives in chapter 2, and he leaves Egypt in chapter 2. As I said, we have Jacob's family who are blessed in bondage. They become multiple and mighty. And I want you to notice in the first verse of Exodus, chapter 1, verse 1, notice it says, these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each with his household. And then it describes all the sons. And each son had a family, and all these families went down. But notice how he says this. It's the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. Aren't they Jacob's sons? How come it's Jacob and Israel? How come there's two names there? He's the same guy. Yeah. All these people die off. And he makes that point. When he gets to verse 7, after he just said all these brothers and all these families died off, look what he says in verse 7. But the sons of Israel were fruitful. So he's talking about the sons of Israel who came with Jacob, who are his physical sons. But he's also going to talk about the sons of Israel who came after Jacob. They're still called the sons of Israel. Now notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't call them the nation of Israel, because they're not a nation yet. No, they went down there as a family. Now the family is growing. And what's interesting about verse 7 is the way it concludes. They're fruitful and increase greatly. It's the word for breeding. They had a lot of kids. And they multiplied. And they became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. You get the idea? They're in bondage and they're just exploding. Think about this. Look at this little section of this verse. And go back to the very first chapters of the Bible in Genesis. What did God tell man to do? Be fruitful and multiply. Yeah. Be fruitful and breed. Have a lot of kids. Fill this earth with your kids. And this is what he's doing for them now in this land, in bondage. Can I be fruitful and have God's blessing even though I'm suffering oppressive circumstances, even if they be minor or major? Yes, absolutely. The land was filled with them, and they're exceedingly mighty. That means there's so many of them that this becomes a threat. Are they in reality a threat to the Egyptians? Threat perceived. Maybe, possibly, these people could be dangerous for us. So the king says, well, let's be smart about this. Let's exercise some wisdom here. Notice in verse 8, this new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. True. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. In the event of a war, they would join themselves with those who hate us, with those who would come to war with us, and they would fight against us, and then they would depart the land. They would leave with all the stuff, and they would leave and leave them without a land, without a nation, without a people. Look at the way they're multiplying. So we've got to do something. So he comes up with a plan. I call it Plan A. It's a plan you think would work. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to put them under hard labor. We're going to try to break their spirits. And we're going to make them really tired. So what happens to the birth rate when people go to bed and they're really, really tired? No energy. They go to sleep. Exactly. Did Plan A work? No, look at verse 11. They appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, and then they had them build these cities called Pithom and Ramses. But look at verse 12. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, the more they spread out. Now, wait a minute. That's not supposed to happen. They're supposed to be really, really tired. Well, it didn't seem to affect them. Let's up the ante a little bit. We're going to continue with this, but we're going to create more affliction. So 13 and 14, let's make harder labor and let's make bitter conditions. So let's make it worse. So that's 13 and 14. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. Now this is a word that means ruthless. They're gonna maybe make it so it's hard for them even to sleep and maybe not get enough food. Like a concentration camp condition. They're really going to make it tough for them. And they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks. the labors which they ruthlessly or rigorously or with severity imposed on them. Things are deteriorating. And yet God is still blessing them. They're still multiplying. That's not working at all. No matter how hard we make it, it's not working. And if the extreme measures don't work, then we got to do a plan B. And what's the plan B? No more mail delivery. Yeah, no more mail delivery. And so 15 and 16, he says, look at this, the king of Egypt, he brings these Hebrew midwives, and this is secretly now. And he says to them, and you know what's interesting here? These are, if you think about this, these are the first two people that have a name. And he said to them, when you're helping the Hebrew women give birth, if it's a son, put the son to death. Now, don't necessarily let them know that you killed the son. Just let them think that their baby died. But if it's a girl, let the baby live. So just get rid of the sons, because if you get rid of the sons, you'll really, really cut down the birth rate. So if there's not enough men, what will the women have a tendency to do? Turn to other nations. Diminish the influence through the men. Does it work? It doesn't work, because he had a problem with the midwives that he didn't anticipate. In fact, the midwives are going to serve someone that he didn't even know. The midwives feared God. And they didn't do what the king told them to do. They let the boys live. He brings them back and he says, what's going on? Why are these boys living? How come you're not doing what I told you to do? And you know what they told him? Well, these Hebrew women are so vigorous, they have their babies before we can get there. They don't need us. And by the time they had their babies and they've seen them and they've seen they're alive, we're too late. That was a lie, you know. That's not really true. They let them live because they feared God. And they weren't going to kill these babies. And you know what's so amazing about this? God doesn't mind. Yeah, that's okay. That's a good lie. But God has to punish them for lying, right? So he does. He takes action. And he does something to them because they lied. And here's what he does. The people multiplied and became very mighty. But look at the midwives. Verse 20. God was good to the midwives. That's our punishment for lying. It came about because the midwives feared God that he established households for them, that he established families for them, and they were blessed and protected. Because you notice, if the king found out they were lying, God's going to protect them. So nothing happens to them. This is one of the first lessons you come to in Exodus here, is that individuals are personally responsible to God. These midwives are brought in by this powerful Pharaoh, and he tells them to do one thing. They say, well, we fear God more than we fear you. I mean, he's worthy of fear, but we don't care. We're not going to do it. Their choices determined what their lives were going to be like afterwards. Now, did they know when they disobeyed him, and he brings them in, and he says, what's going on? And they lie. They know that if he finds out about their lie, their lives are at stake. But they're going, well, that's all right. We're going to lie to you because we fear God. Their personal choices determine their destiny. Now, they didn't know what their destiny was going to be, but it turned out really well for them because God is so good. He has this providential grace. Even though there's affliction and persecution and hardship and bitterness and even killing the babies off, that God still provides choices and opportunities for these two women, which he named in the text. These midwives are blessed and protected, and the sons of Israel continue to prosper. Plan C is, he says to the whole population, let's everybody play kill a Hebrew. The whole population. In 22, the Pharaoh commands all the people, saying, every son who is born, you're to throw him or fling him into the Nile, and every daughter keep alive. That's the command, not just these two midwives secretly. Now he goes public. This is really extreme. I want the whole nation to get involved in this sin of murder. See, the ruling class is really beginning to be afraid of these Hebrew people who are in their midst. Because what the Pharaoh's saying is, you got to save our country from the alien hordes. And he's really getting scared. And you know, when people get scared, they start to look for somebody to blame. So it's time for a historical background. Why is he afraid? Well, the Pharaoh here is Amenhotep, and then he's going to be followed by Thutmose I. Now, you might think, this is all just geek stuff. Nobody really needs to know this. You're going to see a point to why I'm going to go through this. There's some historical background. Now, I want to point out that Jacob goes down to Egypt about 1876. You don't have to remember that date, but I want you to see the spread and the range here. There's a group of people named the Hyksos who, about 200 years after Jacob goes down, they invade Egypt and they take it over. They invade Egypt in 1670. Now, this Pharaoh, Amenhotep, his father, defeated the Hyksos in 1570. Now we're getting down in the range where we are now, because he begins what's called this period of the New Kingdom. And it's Amenhotep who says, I did not know Joseph. Now, he's not saying, I did not know Joseph, meaning, I have no idea who this is. I am totally unaware of anybody coming down here by that name and bringing his family. That's not what that means. Did not know Joseph is Egyptian speak for, we are wiping out his memory. The Egyptians did that. And anything that was distasteful to Egyptian history, they would purge the record. In Egyptian history, there is no mention of an exodus and of the Red Sea and of the Egyptian army being decimated by a god who came down from heaven and decimated them. They mess with the dates on their history, so they coincide with only the good pharaohs that they liked. He wants to wipe out the memory of Joseph. This is intentional. They want to rid themselves of all foreign influence because of what happened under Hyksos. Hyksos came down and took over Egypt. Now, who's Hyksos? Where's he from? The Hyksos people lived up near where, and you're going to recognize this name, near where Laban lived. Who's Laban related to? Abraham. And then who's Abraham related to? Jacob. And who's Jacob related to? Joseph. The people that we just got out of here and got it from out from under their rule, they're related to these people. Now you can start to see some of the political, historical impact that these people are having on them. We suffered under these Hyksos people who were from the same region as this Joseph was from. What if someone like the Hyksos from their region comes back down again? They'll side with them because these are Semitic people. And he's making what seems to be a politically rational move. But he's being foolish because of who he's opposing. If you want more detailed history, you can go on the website and pull this down. I'll have it as a form you can print out, or you can just look at the slide up there. I'm not going to go through this. This is the detailed history of these pharaohs. I will point out one thing in the middle there. This name, this pharaoh here, Hatshepsut. Hatshepsut is a woman. She's the daughter of Thutmose, and Thutmose we're going to meet here today before we leave chapter 2. She is the one who drew Moses out of the Nile, and she would become a later pharaoh along with Thutmose III. You know what happened to her? Well, number one, they didn't like a pharaoh being a woman. They purged her from their history. So this is what I call, this is rebellion in the New Kingdom. There's a family from the house of Levi. Now, why is this rebellion? Well, because they're rebelling against the New Kingdom. A family from the house of Levi. Levi is Jacob's son, right? What was he like? Yeah. He's a violent son. Who was he associated with? Simeon. Simeon, yeah. Well, remember the command? Now, when he makes this command to all people, if you see a Hebrew boy, you're to throw him in the Nile. No matter who you are, you see a boy, you got to throw him in the Nile. Are they going to obey? Look at this. Verse 2. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, that she wanted to keep this baby was beautiful to her, she hid him for 3 months. Why'd she hide him? Somebody else saw him. He was in jeopardy. So his life's in mortal danger. Verse 3. But when she could hide him no longer, as a baby starts to get big, it cries louder and needs more attention. She puts him in a wicker basket. Now, I love this word. The Hebrew word, teva. The only time that word is ever used in the Bible is previously in Genesis chapter 7. What happened in Genesis chapter 7? God told Noah to build a teva, an ark, a box that floats in the water. It's a basket that she covers with tar. What did Moses do with the ark he built? Covered it with tar. Make it waterproof. So she takes this basket, she covers it with tar and pitch, she puts the child into it and sets it among the reeds on the bank of the Nile. So right there, technically, in a way, she's obeying the Pharaoh. She's putting her son into the Nile. But his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. What would she think was going to happen to him? Okay, so if somebody found him, what would she expect what they would do with him? Kill him. Not be found and rescued, but be found and killed. Or he may just simply, nobody may ever come across him, and he may die there. But chances are, when he gets hungry, what's going to happen? He's going to cry, and somebody's going to find him. Maybe she's standing by thinking, maybe I can do something if somebody finds him. Simply doesn't know what's going to happen. She knows his life's in mortal danger, and they can't hide him any longer. The baby's now cast into the Nile. The baby's in an ark after hiding him 3 months. Now he's in an ark. Now, why is that word so important, teva? What is an ark? An ark, as proven in the book of Genesis, chapter 7, is God's vehicle of salvation through the waters of death. Because what was the great flood? Killed everybody. Except the people in the ark. The people in the ark were saved from the waters of death. This baby's not going to get thrown in like most babies. This baby's going to be saved by this ark. So there's the anticipation that this ark is going to be the salvation of Moses, of this baby. They put the baby in the water. Miriam's standing there watching, and the Pharaoh's daughter walks up. It's probably like within a matter of minutes, it seems like. So most one's daughter is the one who comes and finds this baby, and by 5 and 6, she is drawing the baby from the Nile. Pharaoh's daughter, notice, ignores the decree. That's why I call this rebellion in the New Kingdom. Who's the first people to rebel? Moses' parents. The second rebellion in the chapter is Pharaoh's own daughter. How clear is it here that she knows who this is? Look at this. The sister stood at a distance, in verse 4, trying to find out what would happen. Then the daughter of the Pharaoh came down to bathe in the Nile with her maidens, walking alongside the Nile. She saw the basket among the reeds, said to her maid, she brought it to her. She opened it. Miriam's going, oh my gosh, she found the baby. That's Pharaoh's daughter. Baby's toast, done, dead. No, she looks down and says, this is one of Hebrew's children. So she knows it's a Hebrew baby. Miriam jumps out and says, can I go and call a nurse for you from among the Hebrew women so that she can nurse the child for you? I mean, are you going to keep him? Please, 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 keep him? Pharaoh's daughter says an amazing thing. She says, yes, go. So Miriam goes back and gets mom. And mom comes back, and the Pharaoh says to mom, take the child away and nurse him for me. Pharaoh's daughter doesn't know that this is the baby's mom. Go nurse him for me, and I'll pay you. So the woman took the child and nursed him. Such a deal. This is amazing providence. Pharaoh's daughter saves a Hebrew baby, which is against the decree of Pharaoh. Mom gets paid to feed and raise him, and maybe gets to send him to a Hebrew school. You never know, you know, maybe. And then he gets adopted into the royal family. Verse 10, the child grew and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. That's adoption. Now, when he became her son, he now has all the rights of a prince born in the palace. He is now going to live in the palace of the king, and he's going to have the inheritance rights of the palace of the king. Only God could do this. And then she names him Moses or Moshe, but that's not Hebrew, that's Egyptian. Means born out of water. I drew him out of the waters. And if you remember the names of the pharaohs I just mentioned, but Thutmose in Egyptian is Thutmose. See, Moses is an Egyptian name, and many of the pharaohs had Moshe at the end of their names. Born out of water. What water were they talking about? The Nile River. You say Thutmose, he owes his life to the god of the Nile. And so she names him Moshe, because what? She drew him out of the water, the Nile. Now, here's an arrogant presumption, I call this. Arrogant presumption. Who am I talking about? I'm talking about Moses. Moses is from the family of Levi. And look at 11 and 12. It came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw the Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and he saw there was no one around, and he struck the Egyptian down and he hit him in the sand. Now you have to ask the question, why does he do that? Why would he leave the palace and go out, and why would he do that? Doesn't he have everything? Inheritance of the king, living in the palace. Why would he go out and do this? You know, it's only in Hebrews that we get a commentary on why Moses left the palace. We get a commentary on his intention, and he didn't care what the king thought. Here's what it says in Hebrews. The faith that he got from his Hebrew parents, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. I know you adopted me, you're calling me son, but I refuse that. I choose to refer ill treatment. Enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater than the treasures of Egypt. I'm willing to leave the palace. He was looking to the reward. The book of Hebrews described what the reward is. We don't know exactly what was in his mind, but God had evidently revealed something to him about the promise to Abraham and says, you're part of it, and there's a great reward coming. So So he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. And that the endurance in the book of Hebrews means I'm going to hold on to Jesus Christ no matter what's going on, no matter what the circumstances are, no matter what I'm suffering, I'm holding on to Jesus Christ. Now, when it says here he left Egypt, it's talking about he's leaving the palace. I don't care what the king says. I'm going to go out to my brothers. I'm going to go help them. Now, there seems to be a contradiction between this and what we're going to read next, but there's not, because this isn't talking about him leaving the land of Egypt. This is talking about him leaving the kingdom of Egypt, the authority of Egypt. I'm not going to consider that I'm your son any longer. So he goes out and he sees an Egyptian beating one of his brothers, so he kills the Egyptian. Now, the other problem is he didn't understand that his people weren't going to understand him. And this is part of his presumption. His presumption is that, oh, they know who I am and they're going to love me. This is what Stephen tells the Pharisees as he's testifying to them in Acts chapter 7. And he's going through the history of Egypt. When Moses saw one being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. Here's what he was thinking. Now, we don't know what he's thinking until we come to the book of Acts. He supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. He thought they did, but they didn't. So look what happens next. Verse 13. Look at verse 13. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting each other. And he said to the offender, why are you striking your companion? And he said to him, who made you prince and judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid because, going, surely this matter has become known. And 15, look at that. When Pharaoh heard of the matter, he tried to kill Moses, meaning he tried to have him brought to the bar of justice for committing murder. And he could lose his life for committing murder, for killing another Egyptian, even though he's a son of the palace. But see, Pharaoh's already seen him as turning his back on the palace, walking away and associating with his Hebrews. Moses is not afraid of that, but now he's afraid he's going to lose his life. And he's found out that this is a not-so-secret murder, and the Pharaoh's going to be after him for doing this. So he flees. Fear-driven flight. From a misunderstanding to fear-driven flight. He runs for a long, long way. And that's 2:15. And he settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now, the Hebrew wording there is he goes there, and he's saying, this is it. This is where I'm going to live. I'm never going back there again. Now, what he's run to is a distant family. 16 through 20 describes the family of Reuel. And this distant family consists of a godly father, and he's a priest. 16, he's a godly priest, the priest of Midian. With seven daughters, and they come to draw water. The shepherds come, they drive the daughters away, they're picking on them. Moses stands up for them, waters the flock. They get the flock watered a lot faster than the fathers used to, and the daughters come back. And he says, why are you back here already? And he says, well, this guy out there, he helped us, and so we're done. And he says, well, where is he? Bring him. I want to meet him. This reminds me a little bit of Jacob when he goes to Laban, remember, and he meets Rachel at the well and he helps her water her sheep. And then Laban says, I want to meet this guy that helped you. And Reuel says, I want to meet this guy. So when he meets him, he must kind of figure out who he is. And Moses says, you come and live with me? It says Moses was willing to live with him. And he gave him a wife. He gave him one of his daughters, a girl named Zipporah. So he's there with a godly father and a new wife. And it looks like he's set for life. And that's what he intends. Now, when I say that this is family, why do I say that? This is distant family. The Midianites are descendants of
Abraham,
exactly, through Keturah. Yes. So remember, Sarah dies, Abraham marries Keturah, has more kids, and one of these kids is a Midianite. And so you have this priest of Midian down there. That's a little bit like the priest of Salem in Genesis, who was a godly man, who Abraham paid homage to. What was his name?
Melchizedek.
So now you have two of these priests who aren't associated with Israel, but they're priests of God, functioning where God wants them to function. And it's amazing. They end up interacting with the family that's got the promise. So he's there for life, and he has a son. And he names his son Gershom. There's a little bit of sense of loss in this name, because the name in its root means to be banished, sojourner or stranger, a nomad. He lived nearly 40 years in a palace of the Pharaoh, and now he's out here on the backside of the desert in Midian as a sojourner, as a nomad. he came from a very high position, but he also is in this position now because he determined to take hold of the promise of God rather than serve the king in the palace. From palace to desert nomad. Now the chapter closes off that it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died. The one who was looking for Joseph, he died. The sons of Israel sighed. Now we saw the sons of Israel in the very first verse of the first chapter. Sons of Israel came down with Jacob. Then the sons of Israel lived on and multiplied. Now he's going to go back to this name again. He hasn't used the name sons of Israel since those first verses. Now he's going to go back to talk about the sons of Israel. Because here's what's going on. The sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage. They cried out. And their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. And God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel and took notice of them. And the word took notice of them is he knew. He saw and he knew. God must act. It doesn't mean that God had forgotten they were there and he'd gone away and done something else with somebody else and he completely forgot about these people. No, he's now going to act on his promise. And so God acts. He must act. He's obligated to act because he's made a promise to Abraham and he has to keep it. And he's obligated himself, so he must act. So the sighs and the cries are in the midst of this bitter bondage. And God remembers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's the focal point, see. He hears, he remembers, he sees, he knows. So the one who wanted Moses killed is dead. So you come to the end of this chapter. He says, well, God remembers, and he's going to act. Now what's he going to do? What's he going to do? Come back next week. Chapters 3 and 4. God calling a reluctant...